today on Against the Grain. Should Marxism be rooted in interspecies liberation? Or is it already, unbeknownst to most of us? Lee Claire LaBerge has delved into what she considers an unrecognized trove of evidence for Marxism's deep engagement with the feline as a way of making sense of class society and what would be necessary to leap beyond it. She argues that the history of interspecies solidarity between radicals and cats, among other animals, is only now starting to be recuperated. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Monarchical lions, wildcats and syndicalist tabbies, work-avoidant cat memes, and revolutionary tigers. Cats have played an outsized role for radicals, coming to grips with society past and present, and conceiving a future beyond capitalism. And my guest argues, cats are more than just a stand-in for the possible. Lee Claire LaBerge is professor of English at BMCC CUNY. In Marx for Cats, a Radical Bestiary, published by Duke University Press, she takes a 1,200-year look at the place of cats in the human understanding of feudalism and capitalism, including by Marxists. Lee Claire, you argue that felines have been important for how Marxists have understood the past and imagine the future. Can you tell us how so?
I think I would say that Marxism and the history of political economy, which both precedes Marxism and which runs concurrent to Marxism, sometimes a part of Marxism, sometimes in opposition to it, has made use of a sort of wonderful historical archive of all forms of animals and animality to think about the presence and possibility of forms of liberation from strictures of economic dominance. I try to marshal this archive in a way that really shows that radical politics both has the potential to be an interspecies project and then sort of a little bit more radically already is one. And in fact, this archive has been missed, but it's really there for the taking. And so in presenting the archive, I try to sketch out a different vision of what economic liberation not only could be, but perhaps has been.
Would you say, though, that the use of feline symbols and imagery, which your book illustrates in enormous richness, to make sense of the economy, is that unique to Marxism, or could that be said of Western culture as a whole?
I think it could be said of Western culture as a whole. And I would answer the question two ways. One, in doing the archival research for this book, alongside cats, one discovers other animals. Not the exact book, but a similar sketch of economic history could be written using dogs, using horses. These are other kinds of mammals that have been both companion mammals and work mammals. So yeah, I don't think it's unique to cats, nor do I think it's unique to Marxism. I mean, in the book, in the 20th century, I touch a little bit on neoliberals and the rise of neoliberalism, a sort of post-1950s economic philosophy in Western Europe and the United States, and they too made use of cats. So no, there's not necessarily a uniqueness here.
Do you think there is something, and not to get too essentialistic here, about cats themselves that lend them to the role that they have played? Now, this is not just one of being symbols of liberatory creatures, a kind of from below impulse, but also felines have been deployed to make sense of not just, you know, the downtrodden, but also power. Is there anything about cats that you think especially lends themselves to that kind of project? or do you think it has more to do with the proximity of cats? Of course, not all the cats who are deployed in this way are domestic cats, but the proximity of cats to human life?
Yeah, I think that the domestic cat, we now call it the house cat, but the domestic short hair, has maintained a sort of cultural meaning in human history for about 1,000 years of a sort of anti-authoritarian posture. What's interesting about that is that it spans, in my book at least, or in that 1,000-year history, two sort of discrete economic systems, feudalism and capitalism. And in both of those radically different economic systems, the cat assumes a similar anti-authoritarian posture. But as you point out in your question, you know, cat is a large category. And the lion, for example, big cats, assume a similar authoritarian posture in both feudalism and capitalism. So I do think that they're impressively consistent meanings attributed by humans to these animals, this family of animals. And while the forms of authority have themselves changed, the fact of the cat being allied either with or against authority has remained consistent.
So in effect, the cat has played a sort of dialectical role, being sort of on both sides of the class struggle, so to speak. I wonder if you could talk about feudalism. You just mentioned that the scope of your book looks at about 1,000 years of economic and social history, and then the role of cats in human understanding of society. And I wanted to ask you about feudalism, out of which capitalism emerged and obviously superseded. How did the symbol of the cat serve those in power under feudalism and was deployed by those without power?
The book sort of begins with the post Roman imperial world, so the reconstitution of state forms in Western Europe in the 9th and 10th centuries, and at that point in the archive, there are no domestic cats, so to speak of, but of course there's already a well-established imperial exchange from West Africa and from Southeast Asia. So, you know, feudalism is it's an imperial system. It's a war-making system. It's a system of material bounty and booty and accumulation in a way that's different from capitalism, obviously. But one of the things that was collected, that was accumulated to signify not only state power, but church power, of which feudalism is known to commingle the two, obviously, is the lion. And this cat is such a signifier of the unity of state, church, and military might. And, you know, people might be familiar with sort of the English football icons today, which are the three lions, or the association of the lions with the British royal family. These are themselves early feudal icons that persist. Now, by the 12th century, 12th and 13th century, where you have, particularly in what would be today sort of northern Italy, Switzerland, France, beginning of heretical sects, millenarian sects, sects that in different ways seek to challenge and to carve out for themselves other forms of social being and community of the feudal era, already you have an association of these sects, these heretical sects, with the cat. Now, in the early feudal era, it's not only the cat, it's also the rabbit and the frog. But the cat is the one that persists. So In the book, I have different sort of papal screeds and papal bulls and church encyclicals where heretics are identified by their relationships with cats. Anything, any sort of political imaginary that dissents from the Catholic order has an association with cats, whether that be philosophers, whether that be Jews, whether that be sex workers, whether that be vegetarians. I mean, you know, it's sort of a motley crew. How do these things all go together? But what is consistent through these groupings is the cat. And listeners might, you know, well be aware of the, it's itself a feudal association, but of the cat and the witch, you know, witch trials, which begin by the 13th, 14th century and proceed really up until the 18th century in Europe. The cat is a continual presence of the potential for social and economic dissent.
Would you say that the symbol of the cat particularly appears in moments of upheaval, unrest, and transition of some kind? Or are cats, especially those associated with power, also seen in eras of more stability?
Well, it's a tricky question to answer because in the archive where one finds these feline stories and this feline material, they are more pronounced during moments of crisis and moments of rupture. But of course, the archives that are produced in moments of crisis and rupture are themselves usually, you know, more prolific, more tinged with a sense of moral panic. I mean, because often there is a moral panic going on. So one could sort of answer that question in both ways. I mean, at the same time, the reason the cat persists from social rupture to social rupture, moral panic to moral panic over so many centuries is that even during these non sort of critical moments, the archive itself remains, and it remains somewhat consistent.
I'm speaking with Lee Claire LaBerge. She's professor of English at BMCC CUNY, and we're talking about her book, Marks for Cats, A Radical Bestiary. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. We, of course, see the breakdown of feudalism and the emergence of capitalism. And as part of that process, certainly in the history of the development of capitalism in Europe, a crucial element was the enclosure of the commons. How do cats figure into that story?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting question. And I think I should just say that in the book writ large, in the book Marks for Cats, you know, the archive is almost exclusively a feline-based archive. But the larger hope of the book is that cats themselves sort of become a metonym or sort of stand in for an animalistic critique of capital writ large. So in the enclosure of the commons, I mean, you know, this is a process that I think starts happening in the 16th century, which is a post-plague Europe. You have the decimation of between a third and a half of the population of countries in Northern Europe as a result of the bubonic plague. So there's so much transition going on then that it's almost difficult to speak of the precise role of cats in the enclosures themselves, which is really a loss of common land, which includes land of pastures. But I will say that one of the processes that accompanied the enclosures and one of the processes that allowed for the enclosures to be successful is the rise of a sort of carceral system, what we might recognize as the beginning of a carceral system. One of the most famous prisons in England, in London, for housing people who are kicked out of the commons, whose land is expropriated from them, is called Newgate Prison. And famously, on the door of that prison, you know, who knows if this is apocryphal or not, but this is the legend, is a cat. as both symbol of rebellion, something that the prisoners have to hope for a way out. I mean, this is how it was understood. And Peter Linebaugh writes about this. But also as a symbol for the kind of disorder that could be contained within the prison. And in fact, I believe by the 17th century in the English language, female prisoners are called cats, hellcats. So there's already an association with the sort of disruptive female sexuality, the need to criminalize it, the need to warehouse it, to allow this process of enclosure to go forward.
And would you say that that association of cats with women is a consistent thread?
It is an amazingly consistent thread, even as century by century, you know, what constitutes a cat and what constitutes a woman, what constitutes a witch. You know, these meanings themselves shift and change, but it is really impressive. I mean, the sense of a female sexuality that could perhaps be put to work in the form of sex work and thus generate a different economy, a different kind of emancipation and social freedom for women, that needs to be contained. That's associated with the cat. That is an association that one can see really in the archives as early as the 15th century that goes up at least until the 20th century. You know, I mean, one can see it in the arrest and the imprisonment of female sex workers in 15th century, 16th century London. At the same time, you know, Rosa Luxemburg in Berlin in the 1920s, because she's already dead, but late 19-teens, so 1917, 1918, 1919, she's described as, by the German Free Corps, the, you know, sort of proto-Nazi militia that ultimately assassinated her through her association with cats. And communists are described through their association with cats. And Berlin's gay bar at the time is called the Mother Cat. So it's an impressively consistent historical association.
You spoke earlier of the dialectic in the feudal period of the lion and the cat. And in this period of the rise of capitalism, tell us about the tiger dialectic.
Yeah, so the book is divided into sort of four major historical sections, one that deals with feudalism, one that deals with the sort of rise of the bourgeois state, the modern nation state, then one that deals with the sort of great era of bourgeois imperialism, European imperialism, the conquest of the Americas, and then finally the 20th century that looks at communist revolutions. But each section of the book is set off by a dialectical proposition that I try to focus through the language of some kind of cat. So as you point out, the first dialectical proposition is of the lion versus the domestic cat. The lion signifying all that is noble and royal and terrifying about feudal authority. The domestic cat, it's sort of weak other. But as any student of dialectics know, the weak and the strong go together, and it's only in their confrontation that new meanings can emerge. So the second dialectic in the book is what I call the tiger-tiger dialectic. And it's spelled two different ways, T-I-G-E-R, which is, of course, the contemporary English way to spell tiger, and T-Y-G-E-R, which is a 18th to early 19th century spelling of tiger. And what I try to do with the tiger-tiger dialectic is show that in many ways, the tiger is the most dialectical animal of the book. And my listeners might be familiar with the critical theorist Walter Benjamin, who spoke of the method of a Marxist historian as that of a tiger sprung, or in German, a tiger's leap into the past. And what I found through my archives is that the tiger was a sort of omnipresent animal during the French Revolution. So all the great radical French revolutionaries, whether it's Jean-Paul Marat or Gracchus Babeuf or Maximilien Robespierre, were decried as tigers. And tigers were sort of seen as the opposite of the lion. So Buffon, in his book Natural Histories, writes about the tiger as possessing all of the bad qualities of the lion: its ferocity, its violence, its lack of justice, but none of the good qualities, none of the regalness, none of the aspiration toward nobility. And the French Revolution itself can sort of be seen in terms of the tiger. And this is both in the poetry that's produced, in the cartoons that are produced, in the imagery that's produced. And then when the great Marxist historian C.L.R. James writes The Black Jacobins about the French Revolutionary period as it transpired in Haiti, he too focuses on the tiger. So with the tiger-tiger dialectic, what I try to do is show that, you know, just as animals themselves have been left out of the French Revolution, which for Marx is, of course, one of the two great bourgeois revolutions. I mean, it's the single, Marx refers to it as the sort of single greatest revolutionary moment in human history up to that point. But for generations, Marxist historians had completely omitted the story of the Haitian Revolution. Haiti was a former French colony, the most successful slave revolution ever undertaken. And so using these sort of two versions of the tiger, the T-I-G-E-R and the T-Y-G-E-R, these two different spellings that refer to the same thing, I try to show that there are, in fact, two different animal imaginaries of the French Revolution. One of the European state that sort of frees itself from the nobility, and then one of the colonial possession, the slave state, which undergoes this momentous historical eruption, only then to be written out of history. So I try to bring these two together through the language of the tiger.
And in thinking about that history and thinking about the colonization of North and South America, how did the imaginary, the symbol, the stand-in of the cat play a role in that conquest and also the kind of resistance that was marshaled?
Well, you know, with the colonization of North America, and that's really the limits of this book, you know, one of the limits of the book based on my own, the limits of my own knowledge, is the book really does not delve into the Spanish conquest of Mexico, of Central America, and of South America. But there, too, is an incredible animal archive. And I hope that it's one of the legacies of the book that perhaps somebody who works in Central and South America might pick up this project. Because throughout the Americas, the different indigenous nations there, particularly on the East Coast, which is what I'm talking about in this book, the conquest of what today would be sort of southeastern Canada and northeastern United States, but the Iroquois, the Algonquin, I mean, different First Nations had cat deities, and particularly lynx and panther deities. And the presence of these deities, just like the presence of so much of indigenous civilization, was either unavailable to the colonists because of their own forms of, you know, terra nullius and blindness and sort of lack of observation, or was hidden from them as a form of resistance. And that's the case with quite a few of the different myths of creation of the world, of creation of the cardinal directions that come out of the Iroquois and Algonquin nations. They're focused on the lynx. And but again, these religious stories, I mean, they were oral traditions, but they were themselves kept from the colonists as a form of potential resistance. And, you know, it's a very different archive, I think, when you're working with oral tradition. There's some, I think I include one cave painting of a Mishu Pishu, which is a mythical underwater panther that would be present today in like contemporary Ontario, so southeastern Canada. What I tried to show is that, you know, the animal presence throughout the Americas during conquest is both available and it has been obscured. I mean, there's a wonderful book that I cite by the historian Virginia DeJohn about the role that farm animals played in the conquest of New England, that cows, that pigs, sheep played in remaking the landscape. So on the one hand, animals are part of the colonial conquest and that they change, you know, they literally change the land to make it inhospitable to the forms of indigenous husbandry that had been present for so many thousands of years. And on the other hand, they're confronting different feline organizations of social and imaginative and religious power without necessarily being aware of it.
I'm speaking with Lee Claire LaBerge. She's the author of Marks for Cats, A Radical Bestiary, which is published by Duke, and you can find a link to it on our website, Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So in thinking about the moment you've been describing, a moment of conquest and then the establishment, the emergence and the establishment of capitalism, obviously, Marx was the paramount critic of the dynamism, the forces that came into play that led to the emergence of capitalism. And as you note, Marx and Marxism is always a way of seeing that looks both to the past and to the future as a way of making sense of the world. And I wanted to ask you, obviously the book is titled Marx for Cats, how Marx himself drew on cats, understood cats, in thinking both about that past and about a more liberatory future.
Well, I start the book with, I introduce Marx in the second chapter of the book through his family, which itself has a very interesting feline lineage. So Marx on his paternal side, I believe, I'm getting that right, he is a descendant of the famous Katzenelnbogen line of Ashkenazi Jews. So these are Eastern European Jews. And as any of your listeners who speak any German might note, Katzenelnbogen translates to cat's elbow. So Marx comes from this family, of which actually Marcel Proust is also in his lineage. But he comes from this family whose name translates as cat's elbow. And when Marx's relatives, I think his ninth great grandfather was a rabbi with the surname Katzenelnbogen. But in the 15th century, Marx's family left the Rhineland, was now present day Germany. And like many Jews, they went to Venice. And Marx's family there became a very well-established religious family in Padua and in Venice. And today, if you go to the Jewish cemetery right outside of Venice in Padua, Italy, you can find Marx family tombstones, and they all have a small engraving of a domestic cat on them to signify the Katzenelnbogen line. So that was just a sort of random piece of historical research that I encountered. But in many ways, this small discovery sort of animated the whole project. Marx, of course, is born in present-day Germany in 1818, and he lives a very, you know, modern life. He, too, is exiled. First he goes to Paris, then he goes to Belgium, then he goes to London. Marx was a dog person, in fact. Marx himself was not so fond of cats. Now, one of his daughters, Eleanor Marx, sort of his favorite daughter, the sort of Anna Freud of the Marx clan, she was a huge cat person, and she had salons and she was involved in different proto-forms of sort of animal welfare. But the interesting thing about Marx as a person, as a thinker, is not so much, you know, what cats themselves did for him, although he does make reference to them throughout his works, although he also makes reference to lions and to tigers. But Marx is living really by the time he gets to London in the late 1850s, 1860s, he's living during the rise of the sort of Victorian bourgeoisie. And he sees what today we would sort of call animal welfare or animal rights concerns starting to emerge. So anti-vivisection societies, societies for the prevention to the cruelty of animals. I mean, this is what these are called. These associations are called in London in the late 19th century. And he is actually quite opposed to these societies in a way that I think is interesting for leftists to consider and to think about today. So when Marx sees bourgeois moralists try to take up the cause of animals, particularly cats and dogs, what today we might call companionate animals, or animals that are being experimented on in terms of vivisection, he's quite appalled. He's quite appalled by the bourgeois moralism. I mean, this is really how he sees it. And so he himself, I mean, you would not include him in an early sort of pantheon of animal rights figures, of which some are starting to emerge and then again in the 19th century. And I think what's so interesting about his relationship to the idea of animals and the idea of animality and what could be a lesson for us and what I try to make a lesson for us in the book is, you know, there's a difference between the bourgeois concern with, you know, no cats should be tortured, no cats should be homeless, but I'm fine with the whole industrial agriculture practice, which is, you know, causing global warming and pandemics and remaking the world. And he can already sense, I mean, whether it's in terms of the bourgeois associations that are trying to prevent, on the one hand, you know, child cruelty, while on the other hand, putting them to work in every possible factory, you know, on the one hand, trying to prevent slavery, on the other hand, buying every possible parcel from cotton coming out of the American South. I mean, he's really adept to the bourgeois contradiction between sentimentality and domination. And so that's what I think he ultimately offers the contemporary leftist who wants to understand how to think about having both a politics of animal freedom or animal inclusion or just an animal politics alongside a politics which is really critical of capitalism as an economic order. And that's really what I take from him himself as a person, as a sort of 19th century person.
Right. And one, of course, fundamental difference between that kind of moralistic reformist idea of putting a band-aid on some of the horrors of capitalism is that notion of fundamentally transforming society, which Marx thought was absolutely necessary, the absolute rupture with capitalism and the creation of a new society. And I wanted to ask you, to what degree have cats been associated with that rupture itself? You mentioned Walter Benjamin, this idea of a tiger's leap into the past, but of course a revolution is a tiger's leap into the future.
You know, again, this is where the book, the archive that the book marshals is one of cats, but the larger project of the book and the larger hope of the book is that the reader will come to allow for cats to be a kind of stand-in for an entire animal presence. And one of the things that I think the book does, I want to say successfully, but for me it was also surprisingly, is it It attempts to produce a genealogy whereby radical thinkers, really going back to at least the 16th century, now there, of course, we wouldn't speak of Marxists, it'd be anachronistic, but those that we could claim are in a sort of lineage of critics of capital, critics of the then current political economy, there has been really a genealogy of thinkers, of critics, of utopians, of reformers, I mean, who have absolutely reached out to animals to be part of a shared leftist political project. Whether this is John Oswald fighting with the Scotsman who goes and fights with the Jacobins during the French Revolution, or and calls for universal vegetarianism. Or whether this is the Jacobins themselves who understand that in addition to overthrowing the French monarchy, they need to liberate, you know, the king's menagerie, his collection of royal animals. Or in the 19th century, whether this is the Romantics, Shelley, Byron, William Blake, the sort of anti slavery reformers and anti-slavery activists in the United States. In the 20th century, Rosa Luxemburg, Trotsky himself even sometime. But there's this whole genealogy of not only theorists, but really those eager to practice new political and new socio-political communities who reach out to incorporate animals. And I think one of the real sadnesses of the book and of the archive that the book outlines is more often than not, their desire to include animals in a leftist political pantheon leads to their exclusion from that pantheon, or at least their ridicule within that pantheon. I mean, I think Rosa Luxemburg in many ways is the sort of most tragic figure in the book. But she's really tragic for a number of reasons. I mean, one is her being ridiculed by her own comrades for wanting to include animals in her political project. But another is not understanding that her political project might have been more robust for a more robust theorization of animals. So, I mean, this is a long answer to your question, but, you know, what I try to do by establishing a historical archive, a historical genealogy, is to show the desire to include animals in the creation of a new society is itself not a new desire. It's still present. It has been present for a long time. What can we do with it now, right? What can leftists, what can progressives do with it now? And the reason for my own focus on the cats, I mean, not only because I love cats, but because I see so many leftists and so many progressives absolutely devoted to and committed to and in love with their own cats, but unable to think of including animals as sort of political constituents in the project of a future leftist society, of a future progressive society. And so that's really one thing that the book asks us to consider again and again, and it does so by showing different examples of people who have tried to do that historically.
Well, when you think of Marxism, and I guess really sort of radicalism, historical materialism, maybe more broadly, these traditions, fellow travelers of Marxism or kind of within the orbit, when you think of those people and those moments of radical interspecies solidarity, which you document in the book, do you think that despite what you've just described, a kind of tragic unwillingness often to come to grips with the implications of seeing liberation as being not just a human, but also a non-human affair, that despite all of that, do you think that embedded within Marxism is a framework that would allow us to shift to broadening out a notion of human liberation as including non-human animals as well? Or would we see those moments of interspecies concern and solidarity as being more individual acts rather than flowing out of the ideas themselves at their core?
No, I think it's a good question. I think it's an important one. And, you know, I opened the book with a quotation, a little epigraph from Perry Anderson, who says, part of what Marxism offers as a philosophy is the freedom of its own expansion and imagination. And so as scholars of radical politics know, you know, Marxists, practicing Marxists, not all, but certainly some, have a sad history of excluding oppressed populations from their orbit, you know, whether it is colonized subjects, whether it is enslaved subjects, whether it is women, whether it is LGBT populations, whether it is now the trans movement, whether it is indigenous peoples, you know, any leftist project is better for being more inclusive. And Marxism has had to reckon with that and has reckoned with that. Now, it is right now, I think, trying to reckon with what do we make of Marxism in an era of climate change, of global warming, and of ecological crisis. And I think there are different tendencies sort of emerging. There's one that gets called something like eco-modernism, where you have a sort of sense of, okay, the Marxist project has to be to recontrol, to learn how to redominate nature in a way to make it more manageable, more dependable, and more productive to be able to maintain ourselves as a species in an era of ecological crisis. I think there's another tendency emerging, which I hope to be part of, and I hope to encourage, and I hope to, you know, really help flourish and invite others into, which is to say, in an era of ecological crisis and an era of global warming, we need to think what capitalism has done to the planet and what it might do differently. And that is the moment for me of saying, okay, like, we do need an interspecies Marxism. That will be a better Marxism, because an inclusive Marxism is always going to be a more durable one, a more popular one, a stronger one. And you know, this isn't a lesson of the past 5 years. I mean, no less a scholar than Angela Davis has been saying this since the 1970s. But I think it is a lesson that, you know, continual warming, fires, ocean acidification, you know, zoonotical pandemics. I mean, I think it really would behoove us not to think about the possibility of an interspecies project right now, an interspecies political project, as the most palatable one for our moment.
Well, because of time, I'm going to have to sort of skip over what you call the long feline 20th century, the way that cats have played a role as the symbol of revolution. Obviously, the cats in the IWW, the Wobblies, the idea of cats and industrial sabotage, cats and revolution, the Black Panthers. There are all sorts of examples we can see of cats and a revolutionary impulse. But just to make sure that we talk not just about the role that cats have played for humans trying to liberate themselves, but also to talk about cats themselves, I wanted to ask you, when we think about cats, obviously, like other domestic animals, animals that live close to humans, they are intimate witnesses to human history. But can we think of them as historical actors in their own right? You know, do they make their own history? And in thinking of that, how should we think about how cats have been changed by capitalism? What is cat's history in thinking in historical materialist terms?
I think it's a great question. I think that the book itself, Marx for Cats, it's speculative in the sense of ultimately, in terms of the first part of your question, you know, what is their history? Yeah, they're witness to a human history. What is their history? What do they do with their history? How do they perceive their history? That has to be a speculative answer. We don't yet know, like, and nor do we know, you know, to the question of, okay, well, what would an interspecies politics, what would a feline Marxism or an interspecies Marxism ultimately look like? How would cats want to marshal their own history, their own agency, their own subjectivity? I can't answer that question, nor can you, nor can any individual. I mean, that's a future history that we'll all make together. And I only hope that it is an interspecies one. So that would be the answer to the first part of your question that, again, I mean, it's not for us to answer, but it's for us to allow room for an answer. In terms of the second part of your question, how have cats themselves undergone historical transition? I think this is such an important question, you know, because the book, again, the book begins in about the 9th century, Common Era, and really ends with the Trump presidency. So it's a good 1,200-year scope. But one of the things that I hope readers will take from the sort of radical change that cats undergo in their roles as human companions, I mean, from agents of witchcraft to pets, there's a big change, right? My God. And is the fact that that potential for radical change is possible. And the reason we know it's possible is because we've already been witness to it. And I want to bring this back again to the first part of your question, because when people ask me, like, are you really serious about an interspecies politics? What would that even mean? How could you even begin to describe it? How could you even begin to imagine it? It's true. We don't know. I mean, that's what it means to contemplate the future. There's a fundamental contingency and we don't know. But I do like to think about, I mean, can you imagine if you had told, you know, dwellers of capitalist democracies or proto-democracies 250 years ago, like, you know, in the year 2024, cats will regularly sit for portraits, dogs will go to daycare, there'll be schools for animals, people will refer to them as their family, their pets, their children. I mean, that is a radical evolution in meaning. And that is a radical evolution in the human assignment of meaning to a different species. And I think what that has to show us is 200 years from now, we can only imagine the radical of possibilities. I mean, we can't even imagine them. That's how radical they are. But we do know that the radical change is possible, particularly in relationship to animals, because we've already seen it. We've already seen it happen, right? Now let's happen in a way that's a little bit less sentimental, a little bit less concerned with humans' feelings about animals, and a little bit more concerned with animals' agencies and animals' own political spaces and desires.
Well, on that, let me just end then by asking you about the final dialectic that you look at of human relationship to cats in different historical conjunctures and settings. Can you tell us about the dialectic of the cat and the comrade?
You know, it's an interesting one. There's a joke that when you teach philosophy, as a philosophy professor, and you're teaching ontology, you're trying to teach students, like, is something here or is it not here? Does it exist or does it not exist? The joke among philosophers is that you put your fist on the table that you're teaching on, or the lectern, the seminar table, whatever, and you say, is the table here or is the table not here? And you use this to demonstrate the sort of hard materiality of ontology. And one of the things, and this is again a surprising sort of find in the archive, but that first structural linguists, Saussure, but then Marxist literary critics, Frederick Jameson, Terry Eagleton, one of the ways that the signifier signified tension has been taught, right, is the meaning of something inherent in the object or in the linguistic sign attached to it, is through the use of the cat, right? Like, is a cat because it's essentially a cat, or have we just assigned it the letters C-A-T and called it a cat? And so this sort of final dialectic is a way to ask, like, what have cats signified in forms of human community and human comradeship that they might be able to then signify in terms of interspecies communities and interspecies comradeship? And again, I mean, here I think it's sort of the answer to the question is both found within the archive of the book, which is to show that, you know, for hundreds of years, radical thinkers have turned to their cat who was sitting next to them as they wrote and they thought and engaged in conversations with them. And that's not just a form of conversation to a cat. It also can be seen as a gesture of political comradeship. What would it mean to take that seriously and to turn the sort of sign, signifier, signified problematic of literary history into a question of a political problematic of who is a comrade and who isn't? And once we realize that that's an open question, it's a question with multiple possibilities. I mean, that selection, that's a lesson of post-structuralism. Then there's no reason not to include cats and then by extension, all animals in an understanding of political comradeship.
Lee Claire, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Lee Claire LaBerge is professor of English at BMCC CUNY. We've been discussing Marks for Cats, A Radical Bestiary. You can find a link to that book at againstthegrain.org. Her forthcoming book out next year is Fake Work. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.